The following podcast contains spoilers and graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Criminal Adaptations, the show where we take a look at some of your favorite movies and the true crime stories that inspired them. I'm Remy. I spent over a decade working in the film and television industry in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Ashley. I'm a clinical psychologist and forensic evaluator in the state of Oregon.
Welcome back. We are here yet again. This is two times in 1 week for us. First time recording two podcasts in a single week. We are slowly but surely getting, hopefully, better at this. What do you think, Ashley?
Yeah, we're on a roll, so might as well just keep it going.
And this week, we are here to talk about the 2007 black comedy film Stuck, which I am sure most of you have never heard of, because I had never heard of it before either.
Yeah, neither had I. I had not heard of the movie or the tragic story behind it.
I think we mentioned last week we actually saw a YouTube video where they were going over crazy true crime stories that were made into films. This one was brought up, and when we heard what it was about, we were both like, we have to do this. This is a crazy story. And with that, we will get into the 2007 black comedy film Stuck from the late, great Stuart Gordon, starring Mina Suvari and Stephen Ray. The screenplay was written by John Streisick and Stuart Gordon, and it was filmed in St. John, New Brunswick, Canada. Have you ever been to Canada, Ashley?
I actually have not. I have never been to Canada or Mexico.
It is a lovely place. I've only been to Tijuana, so I don't have too many tremendous things to say about Mexico, but Canada is lovely. Screenwriter John Streisick stated that the last name of Stephen Ray's character, Bardot, comes from a Buddhist term described as the transitional state between death and rebirth, which parallels the character's own experience within the film. Though the film did garner some criticism for casting Mina Suvari, who is a white actress wearing cornrows, to play a character based on Shantae Mallard, who is African-American. Random side note here, my friend in college was actually Mina Suvari's personal assistant for a period of time, and we got to hang out in her house one day, and it was a very nice place. She wasn't there, though. This film marks the last directorial effort from Stuart Gordon before his death from organ failure in 2020 at the age of 72. His previous works included Reanimator and the screenplay for Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which is a favorite of ours.
Yes, classic. Ever since you told me that Stuart Gordon was involved in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, I don't even know how many times I've said, I love that movie.
It is a great movie. Believe it or not, that is really all the production backstory I have on this film. There's actually not a lot of information out there. Ashley, should we just get right into the film?
Yes, I'm very curious to see how they adapted this story.
Our film begins with the words that many films that we watch on this podcast do, inspired by a true story. Gangster rap music plays over the opening credits as Brandy Bosky, played by Mina Suvari, hands out medication to the elderly at Silver Cedars Assisted Living Home while working her day shift as a nurse. After changing the bedsheets and showering down one of the patients who had had an accident that morning, the day and time are revealed to be Friday at 9:43 a.m. Once she's finished cleaning up the mess, Brandy's boss, Mrs. Peterson, informs Brandy that she is in the running for a promotion to become the new NA captain, and Brandy is excited and grateful for the opportunity. After giving Brandy the good news, Mrs. Peterson then asks Brandy to come into work again on Saturday, and despite her apprehension, Brandy agrees. Elsewhere, at 12:17 p.m., in an apartment located above an adult video store, Thomas Bardot, played by Stephen Ray, pleads with his landlord to give him another extension on his rent payment, claiming he has a job interview later that afternoon. His landlord, however, is unsympathetic and wants to evict Thomas effective immediately.
Pretty sure that's illegal, but okay, we can suspend belief for a second.
There's a lot of illegal stuff that happens in this story. After a minor physical altercation, Thomas grabs an armful of his clothes and runs out of the building with the landlord chasing after him, screaming obscenities. At 12:56 p.m., Thomas is now alone, walking the streets, looking over the various homeless people lining the sidewalk, still carrying the pile of clothing in his arms as he enters an employment services building. Inside, Thomas walks up to the receptionist to check in and apologizes for almost being late to his 1 p.m. appointment. The receptionist asks him to take a seat and tells him that they'll be with him shortly. Thomas waits patiently for over 3.5 hours before finally being called in to speak with one of the company's headhunters. Personally speaking, I would have said something within that 3.5 hour time span. That's a very long time to wait, especially when you already had a 1 p.m. appointment.
Well, and especially for like a temporary hiring agency, but if you're desperate for a job, I guess you're willing to put up with more.
After apologizing to the recruiter for the pile of clothing he still has with him, Thomas goes on to explain that he was downsized from his previous job and has already run out of his unemployment benefits. Desperate for work, Thomas tried moving to the big city, but it seems as though things just haven't been working out for him. This trend unfortunately continues when the recruiter informs Thomas that he can't find his name in their computer system, which means Thomas will have to start the entire employment process all over again, including paperwork and a 2-week delay before they can offer him another appointment to speak with a recruiting agent again. Thomas tries pleading with the agent and insists that he should be in the system, but the agent shows Thomas absolutely no pity whatsoever until Thomas finally relents and walks away feeling completely dejected. Side note here, when the receptionist calls Thomas to his appointment, she mistakenly calls him Mr. Braddo. This suggests that the reason he is not in the computer system is a clerical error on the part of the job agency. Back at the assisted living home, Brandy and her coworker Tanya, played by Rukia Bernard, talk about their plans to go out to a club later and score some ecstasy, despite both of them still having to work the following morning.
That is a bad idea.
Agreed. Especially if you are a nurse.
Yeah, I'm sure they have to be up early, too. It's a bad idea to go out clubbing when you have to work the next morning, much less go out clubbing and do drugs when you have to work the next morning.
As the evening quickly approaches, Thomas continues walking the streets aimlessly before growing tired and finding a place to rest on a nearby park bench. He is soon joined by a homeless man pushing a cart full of recyclables, who stops and stares blankly at Thomas momentarily, as if unsure of what to make of him, before smiling and offering Thomas a sip from his brown-bagged liquor bottle, which Thomas graciously accepts. The two men sit, drink, and the homeless man even gives Thomas several tips on the best places to sleep at night and how to avoid being hassled by the police officers. The man also gives Thomas one of his spare shopping carts before he leaves, so Thomas can transport his belongings easier. Later that night, at approximately 10:41 p.m., Brandy and her coworker Tanya are partying and drinking cosmos across town at the Hi-Lo Lounge. Brandy soon spots Rashid, played by Russell Hornsby, and calls him over to join them. Brandy and Rashid greet each other by making out for a little bit before he gives her and Tanya a couple of hits of ecstasy. Back at the park, Thomas is rudely awoken by a patrolling police officer who sternly informs him that he is not allowed to sleep there for the night. Thomas kindly asks the officer if he could just stay for the rest of the evening, but the officer insists Thomas go down to the Hope Street Mission across town instead, or he'll place him under arrest for trespassing in the park after hours. Thomas begrudgingly agrees and walks off, pushing his new cart in front of him along the way. Back at the Hi-Lo Lounge, Brandy and Rashid exit the club and are clearly intoxicated. Before leaving, Rashid tells Brandy that he'll be coming over to have a few drinks later, then peels out of the parking lot with his stereo blaring. Brandy giggles at Rashid's shenanigans before stumbling over to her car to head home for the evening.
Ha ha ha, drunk driving is so funny.
She also proceeds to almost run over a pair of pedestrians on her way out of the parking lot, a sign of things to come. Back on the streets, Thomas walks along grumbling to himself about how he just wished he had a place to sleep for the night, while Brandy and Rashid talk to each other on their cell phones while driving back to her place, until her call is suddenly dropped. It is during this that Thomas comes to a crosswalk with a light indicating that it is not yet safe to cross yet, but Thomas proceeds as the streets are empty and there is no one else around. Halfway across the street, Thomas is struck by Brandy's vehicle, sending Thomas's shopping cart flying across the street and Thomas directly through Brandy's front windshield while simultaneously breaking both of his legs in the process. Now, normally, if this were to happen, the driver would just pull over and contact the authorities, but not Brandy. Brandy puts the pedal to the metal and starts speeding down the road as fast as she can, with Thomas still lodged in the passenger side of her windshield, bleeding uncontrollably. When Brandy attempts to try and soak up some of the pooling blood from Thomas's head on her car seat, she ends up grazing the side of a parked car along the street, but still continues on her way as fast as she possibly can. Brandy even passes a pair of police officers harassing the same homeless man from the park earlier, but somehow neither of them notice the bloody car with a pair of man's legs protruding from the windshield driving by high velocity, despite the homeless man making several attempts to point the vehicle out to them. Brandy then briefly attempts to stop at a hospital and remove Thomas's body from her windshield in order to drop him off and presumably flee the scene, but she gets spooked when she hears some approaching hospital employees and once again drives off with Thomas still in her windshield. Saturday at 2:03 a.m., Brandy arrives home with Thomas and hides her car in the garage. Once inside, Brandy exits the vehicle to retrieve her purse from the passenger seat, but is startled by Thomas, who is now conscious and pleading for her to help him. Brandy apologizes to Thomas, but says he really should have watched where he was going. Outside, Rashid has arrived, and Brandy tells Thomas that she's going to get help. Inside her apartment, Brandy greets Rashid and hysterically informs him that she was in an accident on her way home that night, so Rashid tries calming her down with a few shots of liquor. After taking another moment to unsuccessfully compose herself, Brandy confesses to Rashid that she accidentally hit a bum who had been crossing the street. Rashid just laughs this off by saying, "No one cares if you hit a bum, and it's no big deal as long as there were no witnesses."
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, there's some pretty terrible human beings in this story. Rashid then proceeds to give Brandy another hit of ecstasy, and the two end up having surprisingly graphic sex to loud rap music as poor Thomas listens on from the garage. I also think I'm just going to call Thomas poor Thomas from now on, because this poor guy, I mean, worst luck in the world.
Yeah, he's having a really bad day.
The following morning, Brandy is awoken by a news report about a man who was struck by a speeding car the previous evening, but is relieved when she hears that they are looking for a white male and that the victim is already in the hospital. She then searches that morning's newspaper for any mention of the man she hit last night, but finds nothing. After momentarily contemplating calling the authorities, Brandy instead returns to the garage to check on poor Thomas, who is still there smack dab through that shattered, bloody windshield right where she left him. After again confirming that poor Thomas is still alive and conscious, Brandy tells him that she called the police and that help is on the way, then panics before hastily fleeing back to her apartment. Brandy tries calling the hospital, but quickly becomes frustrated by the hospital's automated system and gives up. She then considers calling 911, but stops just short of actually doing so, and instead calls herself a cab to take her to work that morning at 8:35 a.m. However, when poor Thomas hears the idling taxi outside Brandy's apartment, he begins honking the mangled vehicle's car horn in order to get someone's attention. Brandy hears this and heads back into the garage to demand that poor Thomas stop honking the horn, but poor Thomas persists until Brandy repeatedly beats him in the head with a piece of wood, knocking him unconscious. Thomas's luck does not get any better here, folks. At work, Brandy has arrived almost an hour late, and Mrs. Peterson is none too happy. Mrs. Peterson questions Brandy as to why she didn't call if she knew she was going to be late that day. That's when Brandy realizes that she left her cell phone inside the car back at her apartment, and poor Thomas is back there desperately trying to reach it. Thomas tries several times to dislodge himself from the windshield, but is unsuccessful and causes the glass shards from the shattered windshield to just dig deeper into his skin in the process.
Ouch, gosh, he's probably in so much pain.
He is screaming almost nonstop during most of this film, justifiably so. Back at the assisted living home, Brandy tries desperately to convince Tanya to cover for her while she goes back home to check on something, and Tanya reluctantly agrees. After several more failed attempts, poor Thomas finally manages to drag his mutilated body just far enough to reach Brandy's cell phone and call the police, but is unable to give his location or properly describe his situation to the operator before the call is dropped. Frustrated by his continuous stream of rotten luck, poor Thomas begins honking the horn and screaming at the top of his lungs. Outside, a young boy is playing by himself when he hears the commotion and goes over to one of the garage's side windows to take a peek inside. To his horror, the young boy spots a pair of crumpled legs surrounded by glass and blood jutting out from the front of the vehicle within. Understandably alarmed by this, the boy flees to go tell his mother about what he has just seen. The little boy does the right thing and escorts his mother directly over to the garage to look inside and see for herself. So there's no confusion over it's just your imagination, you know, what always happens in movies. They never believe kids. When the mother first lays eyes on poor Thomas from the outside, she reasonably assumes that he must be dead, but quickly realizes that poor Thomas is still alive after seeing him slightly move one of his legs. When poor Thomas notices them, he screams for help, and the mother shouts that they will come back with help as soon as possible. Things, once again, don't quite work out for poor Thomas when the mother and son are told by the father of the house they should not get involved with the police out of fear of deportation due to the fact that they are all illegal immigrants. Back in the garage, Thomas has passed out again while waiting for help when he is suddenly awoken by Brandy. Thomas pleads with Brandy to take him to the hospital and promises he won't say anything to the police, but Brandy still refuses. Poor Thomas then tries grabbing Brandy by the wrist, desperately imploring her to help him, but she manages to free herself and leaves poor Thomas alone in the garage yet again. With no other options, poor Thomas musters every ounce of strength he has left in his body to drag his disfigured limbs through the windshield into the driver's seat. Now bleeding profusely from the various wounds scattered across his torn flesh, poor Thomas tries his best to stop the bleeding by using tissue paper and a plastic bag he finds inside the vehicle. 1:09 p.m. Brandy goes over to Rashid's place to get help only to find another woman inside. The two women fight and Brandy ends up bitch slapping and beating the ever-loving shit out of this poor naked girl, then ruthlessly throws her out into the hallway without any clothes on. And when I say beat the ever-loving shit out of this girl, I mean cartoonishly violent, like frying pans to the face, dishes being thrown all over the place, it's crazy. Finally alone now, Brandy demands an explanation from Rashid, who immediately tries offering Brandy more ecstasy to try and alleviate the situation. But Brandy is pissed and slaps the pills right out of his hand before eventually asking Rashid for help with her much more pressing situation at hand. Back in the garage, poor Thomas has made some progress, bandaging his legs with some lovely car garbage and actually managing to exit the vehicle and nearly crawl to the door. However, his progress comes to a screeching halt when he passes out and Brandy and Rashid arrive on the scene. Brandy explains to Rashid that this is the homeless man she hit the other night, and she needs help disposing of the body. Rashid tells Brandy that she should call 911, but Brandy blackmails Rashid by saying that she'll tell the police about his drug operation if he doesn't help her, so Rashid agrees.
You know, Rashid, I think the police would be more invested in the brutalized man in the garage than your ecstasy operation.
Again, everyone in this film is exceedingly selfish, just thinking of himself and probably not the poor man slowly bleeding to death in Brandy's garage. Brandy and Rashid's first course of action is to bind and cover poor Thomas in plastic bags to ensure he doesn't try to crawl away again, but they are interrupted by Misty, who barges into their garage without any warning. Misty is startled by the appearance of Brandy's vehicle, so Rashid and Brandy quickly usher Misty back into the apartment before she can spot poor Thomas's body. Inside the apartment, Rashid and Brandy tell Misty that the damage to Brandy's car was caused when Brandy hit a deer the other night, which Misty finds completely plausible. Misty then informs Brandy that the reason why she came by was to tell her that Mrs. Peterson found out that Brandy had left earlier that day and never returned back to work, which basically means Brandy can kiss that big fat promotion she was hoping for goodbye. After Misty leaves, Rashid devises a plan to dump poor Thomas's body in the park after sundown. All the while, a curious little Pomeranian has found its way inside the garage through a small hole in the side door and is licking poor Thomas's compound fracture as he anguishly screams out in unfathomable pain. This is the part that reminds me a little bit of Pain and Gain, with the Pomeranian licking gross injuries. Once 5:52 p.m. finally rolls around and the sun has begun to set, Rashid and Brandy continue to debate on ways to kill poor Thomas and dispose of Brandy's vehicle. Rashid eventually returns to the garage to shoot poor Thomas in the head, but poor Thomas counters by playing possum and stabbing Rashid through the eye with a pen he had taken from the employment agency the other day. This is when the story starts to go into crazy town. With Rashid now presumably dead, poor Thomas grabs the gun and hides in the car while waiting on Brandy to come and check on Rashid. When Brandy enters and kneels down beside Rashid, poor Thomas opens the car door, bashing Brandy in the face and temporarily knocking her unconscious. Seizing the opportunity, poor Thomas hobbles out of the garage just as Brandy starts to come to. Brandy chases after poor Thomas, but poor Thomas aims the gun at Brandy and shouts at her, "Why can't you just leave me alone?"
Fair question.
Agreed. This is a very fair question to be stating. Brandy responds to this by hitting poor Thomas in the head with a hammer, knocking him out instantly and dragging his bludgeoned body back to the garage. Back in the garage, poor Thomas has regained consciousness just as Brandy is covering him with gasoline. Brandy plans on burning everything and telling the police that a crazy homeless man had destroyed her garage, killed Rashid, and set himself and her car on fire in a nonsensical blaze of glory. Things don't go quite so poorly for poor Thomas this time, as he manages to turn on the vehicle, hit the gas, and pin Brandy up against the wall of the garage, crushing both of her legs in the process. Completely immobilized, Brandy begs poor Thomas to help her. Realizing her cries may be falling on deaf ears, Brandy pulls out Rashid's gun and fires wildly at poor Thomas. Consequently, the sparks from the flying bullets ricochet off her vehicle, igniting the gasoline, causing both her and the garage to go up in flames, while Brandy screams out in horrific pain as she is slowly incinerated and poor Thomas narrowly escapes with his own life. I remember I was watching this scene from the other room and you just heard all the screaming going on. It took a lot to not explain what was going on at that particular moment. It's a very crazy, crazy ending here, folks.
That's when I kind of realized perhaps this movie might have deviated from the true events that we'll talk about shortly.
Yes, this ending is the moment that I realized that the film has definitely taken some liberties. Finally free, poor Thomas collapses to the ground and is soon helped by the little boy from earlier and several other neighbors coming to investigate the growing fire coming from Brandy's garage. Before heading to the hospital, poor Thomas gives one last look back at the burning garage behind him as we fade to black and credits roll. There's not even any end credit things about what happened afterwards, it's just straight to credits. This movie is less than 90 minutes long here, folks. It's 85 minutes.
Sounds like it's 85 minutes of a pure wild ride.
They definitely don't waste any time. Something crazy happens in just about every single scene. There aren't a lot of scenes with people just sitting around discussing things as we get to know them. Not a lot of insight to things. It's just boom, 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 crazy shit. The film premiered May 21st, 2007 at the Cannes Film Market and opened in a limited release in the US on May 30th, 2008. Do you want to guess how many theaters it opened in?
Before I do that, I'm shocked this was at Cannes.
I am too, actually, with this. This is not what I would consider a prestige award.
No, can you imagine like prestigious filmmakers that go to Cannes every year and all those rich people watching this probably thinking, what the fuck?
Yeah, I don't think the crowd at Cannes would dig this one too much.
As for your question, I'm going to guess 20.
This film opened in just 2 theaters originally, but it was expanded to 16 theaters by the end of the week. The film grossed $67,000 in the United States and another $78,000 internationally, bringing in a worldwide total of around $146,000. If you don't know anything about film profits and all that, that is horrible. That is very, very, very bad if a film doesn't even earn $1 million.
Probably why neither of us had ever heard of this film before.
Yes, it all the pieces are coming into place now. However, Stuck received generally favorable reviews from critics overall, with a Rotten Tomatoes score of 73% based on 91 reviews. The consensus reads, "Steeped in gallows humor, Stuck is a taut, tense examination of a tragic accident." Director Stuart Gordon won the Silver Raven Award at the Brussels International Festival of Fantasy Film, and also the Staff Prize for Narrative Feature at the San Francisco Indie Fest. So this film did get a little bit of recognition. Stuck was even adapted into a Bollywood feature film under the title Accident on Hill Road, starring Selena Jaitley in the Meena Suvari role. I have not seen the Bollywood adaptation.
No, and I think probably one adaptation of this movie is enough.
And believe it or not, that is all I got for this one, Ashley. There wasn't a ton of information on this one. It's a movie that kind of went under the radar and didn't receive much attention.
I'm curious to know what you thought of the movie overall.
Honestly, I thought the movie was pretty good until The Pomeranian. I believe that is the point where I realized this film is taking on a much sillier tone than I had initially anticipated. I believe I had told you a couple of times that I compare this movie to Pain and Gain in its tone. It has a lot of humorous scenes at the expense of a real-life person who went through a horrific series of events. So on that level, I do think it's a bit disrespectful to the victim.
Yeah.
The ending, I just think, is awful and ridiculous and kind of ruins the whole film for me. Up until The Pomeranian, I would believe that this is a pretty faithful adaptation. They probably piled on a lot of Thomas's hard luck to kind of drill the point home. Yeah, before The Pomeranian, I would assume that this is pretty accurate. But I'm assuming you are going to tell me differently.
Let's get into the true story behind Stuart Gordon's Stuck. On December 27th, 2001, two men discovered the body of 37-year-old Gregory Biggs and Cobb Park in Fort Worth, Texas. Cobb Park didn't have the best reputation. It wasn't uncommon for stolen cars and dead bodies to end up in the park. Mr. Biggs's body was partially unclothed from the waist down. Investigators suspected it was a hit and run as there were deep tire marks in the grass near his body. He also had shards of glass embedded in his body and there were no knife or gunshot wounds.
So from the sounds of it, the original plan that Rashid was going to go with, disposing his body in the park, was what actually happened in real life, instead of the fiery conclusion the film ended with.
Yes, he was dumped. An autopsy revealed Mr. Biggs died from multiple blunt force trauma, most likely from a motor vehicle accident. He was said to have lost a great deal of blood. Both of his legs were broken, with the left leg being nearly amputated. Despite the severity of his injuries, the medical expert believed Mr. Biggs did not die instantaneously, but the exact time of death would later be disputed. During the course of the investigation, law enforcement learned a little bit about Mr. Biggs. He spent most of his adulthood working as a self-employed bricklayer. He was a divorcee and had one son, Brandon Biggs, who at the time of his father's death was a high school senior and lived in Albany, Texas with his mother. Mr. Biggs was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, the symptoms of which were well managed with medication. Brandon would describe his father as, quote, "I would say he was very hardworking. He was very friendly. Although he didn't have many friends, he was very loving." 2 years before his death, Mr. Biggs loaned a large sum of money to a woman he was dating to help her pay for her car to be repaired. Unfortunately, the loan was not repaid and caused significant financial hardship for Mr. Biggs. First, his truck was repossessed when he could not afford to continue making payments. He was unable to continue working as a bricklayer without his truck. With no financial income, Mr. Biggs lost his home and started living at a homeless shelter in Fort Worth. He also could not pay for his psychotropic medications, which resulted in a reemergence of his mental health symptoms and made it difficult for him to apply for jobs. Despite his struggles, he stayed in touch with his son and often took him to the movies or to the mall, but the two fell out of touch in the summer of 2001. At their time of their last contact, Brandon said his father seemed to be in good spirits and had been working hard to improve his situation by accepting odd jobs whenever he could find them. With little to go on, the case went cold until February 2002 when law enforcement received an anonymous tip from a woman who would later be identified as Miranda Daniel. Daniel claimed she was recently at a party with her friend, Shantae Mallard, who told her bits and pieces about how she hit a white man with her car, which was why she wasn't driving anymore. Although the basic information provided by Daniel would turn out to be true, there were several inaccuracies which were later identified. First, Daniel claimed Mallard laughed when she made her confession. She also claimed Mr. Biggs was alive in Mallard's garage for several days before he died, and that Mallard had sex with her boyfriend while Mr. Biggs was lodged in her windshield. A close friend of Mallard's would not only dispute these extreme claims, but speculate that Daniel made them because her and Mallard had a falling out around the time of the call. With this new information, police were able to obtain a search warrant, which they used to search Mallard's residence on February 26, 2002. Police officers found a damaged 1997 Chevy Cavalier inside her garage. The hood of the car was severely damaged and most of the windshield was gone. There was blood, hair, and other trace evidence inside and outside of the car. The car seats had been removed and one seat had been burned in her backyard. This discovery resulted in Mallard's arrest. Shantae Mallard was a 25-year-old black woman who worked as a nurse's aide for 6 years. She came from a supportive family, but she did have a problem with alcohol and marijuana and often went to work high. During her initial interrogation, Mallard tearfully described how she hit Mr. Biggs while driving home from Joe's Big Bamboo Club on a long, curvy interstate road the night of October 26, 2001. She admitted to drinking alcohol, smoking marijuana, and taking ecstasy that night. She said the impact of the collision caused Mr. Biggs to fly headfirst through the passenger side windshield while his legs dangled on top of the hood of her car. She said she panicked and drove the few miles left to her house. Once home, she parked her car inside the garage and closed the door. She said she periodically checked on Mr. Biggs throughout the night and cried and apologized to him as he moaned or asked for help. She claimed he was dead by the next morning and called a few acquaintances to help her remove the body, which they put into a trunk of another car and left at Cobb Park. Mallard was initially charged with one count of failure to stop and render aid and released on bond. Those charges were changed once the prosecutor saw the results of Mr. Biggs's autopsy on March 6, 2002, which is when she was arrested for the second time. Mallard was formally indicted for one count each of tampering with evidence and murder on April 25, 2002. While awaiting trial, prosecutors learned additional details of the night of Mr. Biggs' death from three primary witnesses, Tiltsy Fry, Herbert Cleveland, and Cleet Jackson. Fry was a close friend of Mallard's for several years. They were both certified nursing assistants and worked together at the same nursing home. The women bonded as they both considered themselves to be free spirits and liked to party and have fun. The night of October 26, 2001, the women went to Joe's Big Bamboo Club together. They drank throughout the evening, took ecstasy, and smoked marijuana. They left the club shortly after it closed at 2 a.m. Fry offered to drive Mallard home as she had drank less that evening, but Mallard said she was fine. Around 3:30 a.m., Fry received a call from Mallard saying she was in an accident and didn't know what to do. Fry went over to Mallard's house where she found her friend uncontrollably crying. Once there, Mallard went with her into the garage where Mr. Biggs' body was lodged in the windshield of the car. His head and shoulders were inside the windshield with his legs bent over the roof. Mallard explained how she tried to push Mr. Biggs' body out of the car, but he was too heavy and couldn't be moved. Fry encouraged Mallard to call the police and report the accident, but she left when Mallard refused to do so. She would call Mallard on her way home and again ask her to call 911. Fry said she didn't call the paramedics herself because she believed Mr. Biggs was already dead. The next day, she would refuse to let Mallard use her car to drive Mr. Biggs' body to Cobb Park. The next morning, Mallard called Herbert Cleveland, who was also at the club that night but went home with another woman. Cleveland and Mallard were romantically involved, but their relationship wasn't one of exclusivity. After the call, Cleveland went over to Mallard's house and was furious that Mallard involved him as he was on parole at the time. Believing he was already implicated anyway, he called his cousin Cleet Jackson to help him dispose of Mallard's car and Mr. Biggs's body. Cleveland said he chose Cobb Park because he wanted to put the body where it would be discovered for the sake of Mr. Biggs' family. Herbert Cleveland pled guilty to one count of tampering with evidence on September 12, 2002. He was sentenced to 9 years in prison. As part of plea negotiations, he agreed to testify at Mallard's trial. Cleet Jackson pled guilty to the same charge on January 3, 2003. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison, possibly because his girlfriend's car was used to transport Mr. Biggs' body to Cobb Park. He would also agree to testify at Mallard's trial, but he would not be called as a witness. Fry would not be formally charged with anything. She did agree to testify at Mallard's trial to avoid a perjury charge related to lying about not knowing anything about Mr. Biggs' death at Mallard's grand jury hearing before the murder indictment. So for those who aren't familiar with what a grand jury is, it is what is required to formally charge a person with a crime. It doesn't require all the jurors to be in consensus, and there are a lot more jurors than are at criminal trials. Basically, the prosecution presents all their evidence, and then the jury votes on whether it's enough to charge a person. During this is when Fry lied and said she didn't know anything about the crime. She cited not wanting anyone to know about her drug use as the primary reason she lied. Mallard's trial began on June 23, 2003. As she did plead guilty to tampering with evidence, the trial was only about whether she was guilty of murder. The chief medical examiner was a primary witness for the prosecution. He believes Mr. Biggs died from blood loss. As his body was lodged between the passenger seat and the dashboard, he likely had a hard time breathing. In addition to the injuries I already described, his right arm, thigh, and shin were broken, causing severe pain. The defense also called a medical examiner, who was their only witness at Mallard's trial. Although the injuries were not disputed, there were differences in opinion about how long Mr. Biggs was in the windshield before he died, if he did or did not lose consciousness upon impact, and if he would have been able to speak. However, both medical experts agreed that Mr. Biggs would have lived if he would have gotten medical attention, as none of his injuries were to his brain or vital organs. In addition to the medical testimony, Fry and Cleveland testified against Mallard. The prosecution's arguments focused on how Mallard committed murder because Mr. Biggs' death was caused by Mallard's deliberate lack of action. While making this claim, they cited the fact that she was less than 1 mile from a fire station and 6 miles from a hospital when Mr. Biggs was hit. Both locations would have had multiple people there who could have provided the basic care that would have saved Mr. Biggs' life. She also passed 9 payphones on her way home. Further, her brother was on duty at the fire station that night. Essentially, they drilled home everything that Mallard could have done but chose not to do that night. The primary argument made by the defense was that Mallard was not guilty of murder because she did not intentionally kill Mr. Biggs. Rather, she failed to render aid which caused his death. In essence, they argued that his death was the result of a lack of action, which was different than intentionally or knowingly causing the death of another person. Her trial lasted 4 days, and after spending less than 1 hour deliberating, Mallard was found guilty of murder on June 26, 2003. Spending less than 1 hour deliberating on a murder trial is virtually unheard of.
Yeah, from everything I've heard, the longer the jury deliberates, the better it is for the defendant. The shorter it is, the worse it is.
Especially for something like murder, because if they are coming back at less than an hour, it is probably going to be guilty, because if it was going to be not guilty, the state likely would have known that they didn't have enough evidence to go off anything. With her guilty verdict, Mallard could have been sentenced to anywhere between 5 years to spending the rest of her life in prison. The next day, Mallard was sentenced to 50 years for murder, in addition to 10 years for tampering with evidence, which was to be served concurrently, so at the same time. The defense argued for leniency during the sentencing hearing, citing Mallard's lack of prior convictions, addiction, remorse, and that the crime was a culmination of extraordinary circumstances. Mallard testified at her sentencing hearing. She cried throughout her testimony, apologized to Mr. Biggs's and her own family, and told the court she knew she deserved to go to prison. She also spoke about how drugs ruined her life and her desire for substance use treatment. An excerpt of her testimony reads as follows. "I have ruined lives of other people. I have ruined my family's life. I have put people through pain, and I am so truly sorry. I'm so sorry, Brandon. I'm so sorry for what I have caused your family, and I'm so sorry for the pain I have put my family through. I'm so sorry for the crime I've done to society. I really am very sorry." During cross-examination, the prosecution asked her about her partying habits, including how she often went to work stoned for 6 years. They also highlighted the fact that she went back to the same nightclub a week after Mr. Biggs died. Brandon Biggs, who was 20 years old at the time, also testified. Mallard cried throughout his testimony. His testimony read in part as, quote, "To the Mallard family, we would like to say we are sorry for your loss as well. There are no winners in a case like this. Just as we all lost Greg, you all will be losing your daughter. To Shante, I personally would like to say that I accept your apology. In return, I hope you would accept my forgiveness." Mallard filed an appeal a few years later, claiming the evidence presented at her trial was insufficient to sustain her murder conviction. She argued that the trial court erred by defining the intent level to the jury for the murder charge and should not have overruled her motion for a mistrial based on a statement that the state made about how she had remained silent after her initial confession. Her conviction was withheld on March 5th, 2005. And I kind of agree with like the last point, like it is fucked up for the state to try to use her silence after the confession as evidence of guilt, because it is our Fifth Amendment right to remain silent and avoid self-incrimination. And you're not supposed to use evoking that right, not speaking to the police and not testifying at trial as a sign of guilt, because it is in the Constitution that you have the right to do so. Brandon Biggs filed a wrongful death lawsuit, which was settled out of court for an undisclosed sum. He publicly forgave Mallard. Shortly after the trial, he was presented with a $10,000 scholarship, which was the result of fundraising efforts by several people who were convicted of murder from various states around the country, which I thought was really, really cool. This case is really tragic, and I think the one thing that's really heartwarming about it is just how Brandon dealt with it all with such grace and forgiveness. I think that is something that most people, including myself, would have a very hard time doing.
Agreed.
Mallard is serving her sentence in a prison in Gatesville, Texas. She will be eligible for parole after she serves half of her sentence, which will be in 2027 when she is 50 years old.
That's not that far off.
No, just a couple years now. If she isn't paroled, she will be released in March 2052 at the age of 76. She has had no misconduct reports throughout her incarceration.
So it looks promising she'll be released in a few years.
It's really hard to say because it's Texas, and Texas is notoriously known for being very stingy and anti-parole. That is the true story behind Stuart Gordon's 2007 film, Stuck. What did you think, Grammy?
I think they should have stuck to the real story in the end. I think that there was plenty of things that they did not cover in the film, such as their backstories, the trial. What actually happened is far more interesting and tragic than the ludicrous, over-the-top ending and Pomeranian thing that we ended up with on film.
I agree. I think they could have made this a very thought-provoking film if they would have stuck more to the true content. It is a very sad story for everyone involved, obviously for Mr. Biggs and his family, but also for the Mallards. This woman obviously made a horrendous and awful decision that day. She was also intoxicated at the time, clearly not in her right mind, and failed to do what she should have done. And I think a very serious question that I had grappled with throughout this is, her actions the same as murder? Because it did result in his death. I think the defense put up a really solid argument about how should murder be considered the same as deliberate inaction.
So were they trying to get this converted to a manslaughter charge at any point? Is this in that category?
That's probably what they were doing. So, I mean, at criminal trials, if someone is charged with murder, she wasn't charged with like manslaughter or negligent homicide.
What is the difference between manslaughter and homicide? I genuinely don't know.
Different states will have different definitions of each. Usually, murder includes someone intentionally committed an action with the intent of severely harming a person to the point of potentially killing them. Some of the other ones, like negligent homicide, is essentially like you acted recklessly and that resulted in another person's death. So it wasn't like you deliberately killed the person, but you acted in a way that a normal person would have known you shouldn't be doing because it could have severely harmed another person. So usually people like drunk drivers that kill someone, they're usually not charged with murder because they didn't intend to kill a person, but they should have known that their actions had that possibility. All states define these different crimes differently, and all states can instruct their juries to consider those or not consider those. So I'm not really sure if the jury had the option to consider some of these lesser offenses or if it was just murder or acquit. If that would be the case, that would have actually been at a disadvantage to the defense. I think it would have been extremely hard for the jury to hear all of this. They were also shown pictures of Mr. Biggs and his gruesome injuries. So after you show a jury that, like, emotions are running wild and no one is going to want to do an acquittal. But this is definitely one case that I kind of want to revisit maybe in a couple years if we're still doing this to update. I'm going to be very curious to see if she does get paroled in 2027 at the age of 50. She has no criminal record. She had been working as a nurse's aide for her whole adult life, and she's remained disciplinary infraction free. If the whole purpose of keeping someone in prison is to protect society, the parole board is really going to have to consider if this woman is a risk to us if she is released.
It seems as though parole not being granted is sometimes due to the severity of the crime and not their behavior in prison.
And I think the political backlash from the community of if this person got paroled plays a huge role in parole board's decisions.
Yeah, if it was all over the news and it had a lot of public attention to it, yeah, I would imagine that would affect things as well.
A lot of times, too, at parole hearings, the parole board will invite the victims. They have the right to witness the parole hearings and also to write letters recommending release or not. So I will be interested to see what Mr. Biggs's family would say in this case, if anything. So this will definitely be one I'll probably mark down in my little book somewhere and start scouring the news in a couple years to see if she's paroled.
It makes me wonder if Jodie Foster missed the last parole hearing for John Hinckley, who was released from prison after attempting to assassinate the president.
Well, released from a psych hospital, so it would have been a little different.
Yes, my mistake.
But yeah, that is the story behind Stuck. Any last closing thoughts before we just get into the rating?
I just want to say that we chose this because it is a genuinely interesting, under the radar, unheard of type story. And we do like doing these. I know that most of you probably have not heard of this actual true crime or the film either, but we're very glad that you would give this a try. If you want to watch the movie or look more into this case, there's stuff out there. And we just found this to be very interesting. Honestly, I wish there was more material that we could have covered in this episode.
And with that, we will get into our rating system. If you are listening for the first time, at the end of each episode, we compare the movie to the true story and we give it one of three ratings. If we feel like the film stuck pretty close to the source material behind it, then it will get a not guilty rating. If the film deviated a bit from the story, included some of its own liberties, but the real essence of the story is still there, it'll be a mistrial. If there is just too many differences, or if it is just so loosely based on the true story that we can't really see any of the true crime in the movie, then it'll get a not guilty verdict. So Remy, I usually kick us off, but for this one, I'm curious what your thoughts are.
I think for this one, I'm landing on a mistrial for this. I feel like there were a lot of details in there that I heard you go over in the true crime. Of course, that ending was just completely out of left field and completely inappropriate at the same time. But there were a lot of things. The character of Rashid mentioning what happened in real life, the plan to dump the body in the park. A lot of the other events where Brandy had sex with Rashid while he was still stuck in the vehicle. I know you said that wasn't confirmed.
The anonymous source said that's what happened, but it was a lie.
Okay, so they had taken that from the anonymous source, I'm assuming, because it just adds a level of craziness and horribleness to the story.
It makes definitely the perpetrators seem heartless.
Yes, and I do think that was what the film was trying to get across. In the end, this one gets a mistrial from me. I think they got a lot right. She was a nurse. Both of his legs were broken. There was a lot of stuff that did correlate. There was also a lot of stuff like the Pomeranian and other random things that were thrown in there for no reason. This film gave me a Pain and Gain vibe with the way that it portrayed this story almost comedically. The film starts with her changing a pair of shitty bedsheets, which seems like the type of humor I would see in a Michael Bay movie. In the end, mistrial from me. How about you, Ashley?
Remy, I think this is our first disagreement.
Okay, this is, yeah, the first time we've agreed on every single film up until now. What do you think?
I'm giving it a guilty, and I'll tell you why. I think they deviated more than they stuck to the events. So yes, a person was lodged in a windshield, but he was not screaming in the car, honking the horn, trying to escape. He physically could not do those things. You know, there was arguments about whether he even regained consciousness at all after he was struck. If he did, he would not have been able to breathe very well, much less talk to her coherently. I also disliked how they incorporated all of the more heinous accusations that Miranda Daniel made against Mallard and put those in as what happened. And then the ending is just completely different with all of the unnecessary violence and just, you know, all of that. I don't think Mallard was this malicious person who was solely looking out for herself. I think she was scared and she didn't know what to do and she just got to the point of no return. So for those reasons, I'm going to give it a guilty verdict. I can see how some people would also argue mistrial. I went back and forth between the two.
With that, the first disagreement on voting has occurred. This is a historic moment, Ashley.
It is, and I would love to see what you guys think. We don't have it yet, but by the time this podcast is up and running, we will have a Instagram page where we will be putting information and pictures about each of these crimes, kind of comparing the movie version of them to the real life people involved. So if you don't follow that, please do follow that. We'll have a link in our episode notes and go on that page and tell us what you think.
Please. And if you are enjoying the content, please like, comment, subscribe, all of that good stuff. Like Ashley said, we are working on our social media stuff. If you do leave us a 5-star review and comment, we will give you a shout out next season on the show. And yeah, we just are very appreciative to anyone and everyone who has given the show a chance. And we would like to show that in whatever humble way that we possibly can.
And join us next week. We are going to be tackling a film and story that is much, much, much more well-known. We're going to be talking about Foxcatcher, the true story about the Schultz brothers, the murder of Dave Schultz by John DuPont.
My stepdad actually met Mr. Schultz at the Olympic tryouts back in the day, so I may have a little bit more insight on the real man during the next episode. I have also seen this movie before, and I am a fan. It's a great film, and we recommend all of you to check it out as well.
It is a great film. I haven't seen it in a very long time. I mean, it has three really heavy hitters, Steve Carell, Channing Tatum, and Mark Ruffalo in the three main roles. It's a great movie, and there's several documentaries out there that I've already watched, and I've read the book as well. So there's a lot of material to go over for next week, and we are excited to talk about it with you.
Yes, Ashley has already dove headfirst in all the Foxcatcher material, and now it is my turn to catch up. It will no doubt be a longer episode next time. We like these short ones too. It's just, you know, it's nice to have a change of pace from time to time.
And until then, have a great week, and we'll see you soon.
Goodbye.